The treasurer will be a little late in the meeting, so we're going to start with Adam. So, review and approval of the minutes.
Move approval.
All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, committee report, John.
All right, the Finance Committee did meet earlier this week on Monday, at which time it approved the following commitments. Up to $20 million to Union Square Ventures 2016. $45 million to GGV Capital 6. $15 million to GG Capital 6 Plus. And another $20 million to GGV Discovery 1. And then finally an up to $250 million commitment to Green Equity Investors 7.
This morning, staff in Torrey Cove would like to make a recommendation to invest $500 million in Vista Equity Partner 6. We have a, Oprah has a relationship with Vista back to 2007. And in their first institutional fund, which was Vista Equity Partners 3. The numbering, it was their first institutional fund. We invested $100 million in Fund 3, $100 million in Fund 4, $200 million in Fund 5, $75 million in their foundation fund, too. At that time, the original time when we first underwrote the original Vista investment, it was Robert Smith, Brian Sheth, and a team with a great thesis, some track record, a dynamic leader, and an interesting story. And we've watched them grow into quite a machine. They are one of the most consistently outperforming funds in our portfolio. They played a very valuable technology role in the portfolio. They still do, but now I think it'd be safe to say they're just one of our top-performing funds that we want to continue to back, and thus the larger commitment size recommendation. I can go into depth about the firm, but Robert can do a lot better job than I can, so I'll just turn it over to him from here.
Thank you, Andy, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for inviting us here again to spend time with you. I'm Robert Smith, the founder, chairman, and CEO of Vista Equity Partners, and as Andy has said, we have had a wonderful relationship with you all now going back almost 9 years. We first had our first institutional fund in 2007. We then have had, since then, two subsequent flagship funds and a foundation fund, which we've been a part of. And the good news from our perspective and yours is our strategy has not changed. We are focused, and I'll spend time on that today, we are focused on what I still believe to be the best investing opportunity probably for the next few decades, and that's enterprise software. The way we like to think about it is, quite simply put, enterprise software is the most productive tool that's been introduced in our business economy over the last 50 years, and likely will be for the next 50. It has created massive amounts of productivity through various industries. Almost every industry is now going through a digitization process, and so the actual acceleration of enterprise software, we characterize it enterprise software, data technology, and enabled services. That acceleration is leading to, again, a rapid pickup in the consumption of software across every industry. And part of what we do is identify those mission-critical, business-critical enterprise software businesses and bring a very specific brand of alpha creation, in the words of our investors. But really what we do is change the business models and make them more efficient. The short answer is this. Enterprise software is a 95% gross margin business. If you think about it, you build it once, you sell it many times. Every time you sell it, you don't use it up. There's no inventory, and there's negative working capital. And most importantly, there's no CapEx. And so to the extent you can take these 95% gross margin businesses and create long-term relationships with your customers, and those relationships are actually measured in decades, not in quarters or in years, and you make an efficient delivery of that business, of that software to your customers, you generate massive amounts of free cash flow that then can be used to add additional products to extend the relationship with the customers or return in the form of either in the form of recapitalizations or ultimately sales of those businesses to strategic and financial parties. We have now done this over the last 16 years. We have now effected almost 200 transactions. We have, for institutional investors, a 0% loss ratio, and never lost money on a buyout deal ever in almost 200 transactions. So what I'd like to do today is spend a little time to talk about how we do it, and then, of course, open up for questions that you may have across our portfolio. So first of all, you hopefully have books in front of you, and I'll start on page 4. Since our lawyers take up the first couple of pages, and in essence, the way we do this is we have a whole series of best practices. We call them VISTA standard operating procedures. And in essence, we work with the management teams and train them to become more effective at driving that 95% gross margin into a high free cash flow margin. And it is a system in which we can deploy it across the functional areas across a software company. We've now, again, of course, done this over almost 200 transactions. Our gross returns have been just over 3.4 times cash on cash and just under 40% over the last 16 years, again, in a zero loss ratio. We now have an investment team and an operating team that totals almost 200 people, and I'll break that down in a few moments. And we also have, in addition to our private equity business, we now have a credit business and a public strategies business which takes advantage of the expansion in enterprise software from a credit perspective and also our intelligence around seeing almost every single software deal on the planet as they come through our system. If you flip to page 5, again, one of the important parts of this is we are now probably the 6th or 7th largest software company in the world. If you add up all of our holdings, we've now deployed just under $12 billion of equity in return. About $8.5 billion, and again, we have never held any of our businesses at below cost due to the way that we can expand the value of those companies. We employ approximately 35,000 people worldwide now and touch over 30 industries in the work that we do, and over 175 million users of this software. Again, this is mission-critical, business-critical software. The way we like to define that is, if we turn it off, is our customer in business any longer? And the short answer is no. That's how we think about it. One way to think about it is, you know, every company has now become a software company to some extent. I had the good fortune of being in at the World Economic Forum last week and leading a panel on the Internet of Things. And what is so dramatic is every single industry is going through a digital transformation. In fact, that whole conference was called the Fourth Industrial Revolution, which in effect is embracing all of the components that make up the digital transformation of a company, which include the sensors, the Internet of Things, which include the platform, which is software, which includes the data, the analytics around it, and ultimately the cognitive systems that sit on top of that so that businesses can make more effective decisions. You know, the way we like to think about it, companies like FedEx that are really nothing but a software company that owns airplanes and trucks. And so every single business out there, think about hospitals, hotels, power grid operators, in essence, those businesses have all been transformed through software. And what we'd like to do is bring, again, operational performance to those businesses, enhance their relationship with their customers, extend those relationships, and yield free cash flows off of those businesses. We have had the good fortune in 2014 of being ranked as the top private equity firm in the world from 2000 to 2009, and then last year they named us the top one private equity firm in the world from 2002 to 2011, which gives us about 12 years of run so far. Flip to the next page on page 6, and it gives you a series of companies that we own or have owned and the industries in which they participate. And the point of this is, ultimately, the diversification that you get through enterprise software goes across every single one of these industries. Comma, however, what's interesting is you are actually not correlated. Our returns are not correlated to these underlying industries, typically because it is mission critical or business critical. So, in effect, even during the worst economic downturn, in at least in my lifetime thus far, in 2008, we were able to expand our EBITDA across our portfolio by about 47%. Because you bring massive productivity to your customers, if you can demonstrate that productivity from an ROI perspective, you can price against that productivity and actually extend the relationship, again, in periods of time measured in decades. The other thing I would also point is there are also what we call horizontal software companies, which you see in the middle, some of which are companies like ForcePoint, which is actually one of your Fund 4 companies, which we sold to a company called Raytheon, which is a company WebSense. We sold it to Raytheon, made about 3.2 times our money, about a 62% IRR. And they invited us back in to reinvest, which we have in Fund 5, because they said, listen, you know, Raytheon, which, as you all know, make missile defense systems, et cetera, Patriot missile, et cetera, said, listen, you know about running software businesses. We know how to develop technology. The combination of these two businesses, leveraging your business systems, will make a better company. And we then reinvested in that company, which is now called ForcePoint. And that is what we call a horizontal software company, because it actually covers multiple industries with the technology that we sell. We actually just sold TransFirst, which was a Fund 5 deal. We sold that at 2.95 times MOIC and 111% IRR, so that's Fund 5 that you folks are in. And in essence, it is a transaction processing company. So it ties into the back end of merchant payers. And the advantage of that particular company is we can actually plug it into each of our software businesses like Greenware, where we have over 80,000 physician practice managers or physicians' practices that use it, and actually now that will be the transaction processing engine on the back end of it. Or plugging into companies like Celera, where we have 54,000 small to medium repair shops that use transaction processing and are able to drive revenues in that context. So that in those cases, we will buy horizontal software companies in addition to vertical. On page 7, this is where I'll go through what I call a little bit of the explanation of how we work. The way I really like to characterize this is the typical private equity firm is a bespoke firm. You know, you have 4, 5, 6, 8 partners, and in essence, they will come up with a thesis. Individuals will have a thesis around oil and gas. For instance, oil is going to go from $80 a barrel to $120, and here's 25 companies that if that thesis holds correct, we will make money on, and here's a series of executives that we can bring to bear to make money in that thesis. Or, you know, healthcare is going to expand because we have an aging population, etc. And in essence, they aggregate those deals in the form of a fund and raise a couple few billion dollars and typically return whatever 1.7 times MOIC, which is 500 basis points better than the Standard Poor's 500, and then they come back and get re-upped. We work completely differently. What we do is we focus on one thing, enterprise software. And that investment team have over 80 people who do nothing but look for these businesses. Business critical enterprise software companies. Then we have a group called BCG, Vista Consulting Group, which we have now have 86 people. We'll be at 90 probably by the end of this quarter. And they focus on bringing to bear operational tools to help our managers run these businesses more effectively. And we have over 80 of these now. We call them Vista Standard Operating Procedures. And then we train these executive managers. And executive managers are typically folks that, you know, half the time folks in companies that we buy, they stay with us and we train them. And in some cases, they come from other portfolio companies. We now have over 100 or so of these executives who are now trained. And when I look at it, there's about 75 who are on their second, third, fourth, or fifth company with Vista. And what that does is improve our efficacy of the transformation in these businesses. And that plays out into what I call a more rapid expansion of EBITDA and a more rapid expansion, ultimately, in the top-line growth of these businesses. They now know the language of these VSOPs. They now have their peer networks established, and they have an efficiency to the work that they do. And, in effect, those three, if you think about how those three groups interact, that is how we're able to put more capital to work faster and actually increase maintaining the same MOIC and increase our IRRs through the context of improvements in our cycle. It is very much what I think about as an industrialized approach to private equity as opposed to a bespoke approach to private equity. And in essence, when that works well, which it has, and as we continue to expand our opportunity set in enterprise software, we're able to do more deals and we can actually make a shorter time to value in those transactions, which gives us the ability to do companies like TransFirst and make the changes in those businesses and triple the value of those businesses in shorter periods of time. It's the efficacy of that engine which makes that all work. If you look at the next two pages, pages 8 and 9, this is what I call the best demonstration of that. In my mind, financial performance is nothing but a trail in the sand. It is really just an indication of the projects or the work that you have done. And we don't manage to, quote-unquote, specific financial metric. What we manage to is making the companies more efficient. And if you look at the EBITDA, which is, this is a time series analysis of every single company we've ever owned, at time T equals zero, on average, is about a 16% EBITDA margin. Typically, 2 to 3 years after we've owned the business, we've doubled that. 3 to 4 years after it, we've tripled it. And that is through the implementation of these best practices in the business. Now, once we have started those implementation and we've what I call stabilized the business and created an efficient platform, you look down at the bottom, this is the revenue growth across those businesses. Now we can actually take advantage of an efficiently operating businesses where we can actually now upsell our products into our customer base. The vast majority of the growth comes from what we call white space, selling existing products to existing customers. And part of those existing products are those that we've developed in the company, and part of those are things that we buy ultimately as part of add-on acquisitions. And so those add-on acquisitions, as well as the product development, when you have an efficient delivery platform, gives you the ability to accelerate your top line. Our average company in our portfolio today is growing at 11.5% top line. We have 8 companies out of the 30 that are growing at over 10 times GDP. That's the efficiency of the model as it plays out in EBITDA and in revenue growth. And the next page gives you just a little bit of a snapshot of the competitive environment. Not surprisingly, this environment has become more competitive as people, A, are seeing the amount of consumption in software, point one. Point two, that the market caps of software companies are continuing to accelerate. In fact, over the last 6 years, it was the fastest growing market cap segment in the financial market space. And so that attracts more capital. As it attracts more capital, you end up with more competitors. But as you can see, since 2010, we still have done more transactions than anyone else. Our ROIC is higher than anyone else on this page. Our return on equity is higher than every company on this page, including the strategic folks like Oracle and IBM. And our loss ratio relative to the other financial players is lower. We have a 0% loss ratio versus these others. And so in aggregate, one of the keys is now that we have built this efficient system of over 80-plus investment professionals and over 85 now operators in BCG and consultants, and now over 100 or so trained operators within our portfolio company, we can continue to accelerate our pace in not only deploying capital but returning capital, and there's been no diminishment in our MOIC and actually an acceleration in our IRR over the last 5 years. If you look on page 11, this just gives you net numbers. Our first flagship fund, which is DEF2, 2.73 net. That's completely closed and done. 29% IRR, and that's net. The first fund you've invested in so far is at about 2.47. There's still 4 other companies. I expect that fund to be fully realized by the middle, if not the end of the year. And it'll be close to 2.8 times MOIC net to you folks as LPs, and again, about a 30% IRR. Fund 4, I look at that one, and I think it's actually going to perform better than Fund 3. We have a few dispositions in Fund 4 that we are actually in process on. Sovos we just sold, which was at a 3.15 times cash on cash, which was a Fund 4 deal, which we sold 3 weeks ago, which you'll see reflected in next quarter. And the IRR on that deal is about 63%. So you're going to see, again, an acceleration in MOIC in Fund 4 and acceleration in IRR. And Fund 5, again, was TransFirst. It's, again, a young fund, 2014. We just sold TransFirst last week. Again, 2.95 cash on cash and a 111% IRR in that fund. We have a co-investment fund, which is still performing at about 3.1 times net MOIC. And you all are in Foundation Fund 2. The first Foundation Fund currently is at about 2.9 times MOIC, 43% IRR, and we expect that to close at a gross over 5 times MOIC. The net, depending upon where each of these sell, will be obviously much higher than the 2.8, closer to 4. And you all are now in Foundation Fund 2, and it matches up and aligns pretty closely with Fund 1 and the Foundation Fund. The only difference in strategy is they're just smaller companies relative to the flagship fund. Our credit fund has been performing spectacularly at about 14% net IRR, and we're in the process of raising credit fund 2. And we have a public equities fund, which has been returning to about 18.2%. The next page on page 12 just gives you a sense of what we've done over the last 12 months. if you were to take a snapshot of where we were this time 3 years ago, 4 years ago, you'd see about the same number of investments, maybe, you know, 10-15% less in the number of platforms and add-ons. And the liquidity events, the difference would be the gross MOIC would be about the same, 3.4, and the gross IRR would be about 38%. It's now at about 53% and has been accelerating. Again, I think this, again, is an indication of the efficacy of our model as it now plays out in the market. The next page really just walks through performance awards, et cetera. The team on page 15, I'll hit this really lightly. We have not lost or gotten rid of any senior professional in the last 8 years. It's the same team, just continues to mature and grow and expand it across our three offices, which is San Francisco, Chicago, and now our headquarters in Austin, Texas. I don't anticipate adding any more what I'll call senior level people going forward, but the continued expansion of the opportunity set. The big change in Vista over the last 5 or 6 years, and from a team perspective, is the orientation. What we have done is actually take our senior people who were really focused initially on not only finding the companies and driving the transformation activities the first 4, 5, 6 years of our 16-year history, and we've now expanded VCG so those transformational activities are now driven much more by VCG, and our operating partners, our investment team, can be much more outwardly focused on finding companies that fit our model, point number one, and point number two, managing those companies through the valuation or through the disposition process. So that's been the big change in how we manage the business from a personnel perspective.
Mr. Smith?
Yes.
Question for you.
Yes.
So you're raising a larger fund and facing more competition and reorganizing your firm to look for better opportunities. Are they moving to other places around the world? Are you having to look at different stages of companies? How is your business evolving given the good capital out there?
Sure. Great question. I'm going to answer it in three parts. The first part, and I'll go backwards if that's okay. Geographically, the vast majority of the software businesses that we buy are still North American-centric and really U.S.-centric. These businesses, you know, because of our capital market space, because of, I'll call it the innovative nation that we live in, we see the vast majority of the opportunities still here. That said, we now, and you all as well, own two of the three largest software companies in the U.K. One is a company called Mises, which is dominant in its space, which is for core banking, treasury management, and risk management solutions. And the other one is called ACS, which actually has dominant positions in two separate verticals. I don't anticipate that we will have put any, call it boots on the ground, feet on the ground in any other theater, because we can execute in the U.K. and out of Europe out of our current base. And I don't see a lot of buyouts actually happening in Asia. There is a vast, what I'll call, proliferation of opportunity in terms of software and building software companies in Asia, but many of them aren't at that stage where they're ready to go through a buyout. You know, typically they are still in the hopeful stages of going through the IPO, everyone's seeing the crashing in the market there, in the public markets, and I don't expect that in the next few years we're going to see what I'll call the real selling and realization that these businesses really need to be owned by a buyout firm. So my expectation from a geographic perspective, we're going to continue to do the same, execute the same, our footprint is going to be the same. The stages that we're focused on, it has not changed. We still do buyouts of what I call mature enterprise software businesses, comma, however. What has changed is what defines a mature software business. You know, 15 years ago, 16 years ago, when we first stood up Vista, it took 19 years on average. You know, our average company was 19 years old. It typically took 20 years for a software company to mature. Software companies mature now in a much shorter period of time, mainly because of what we call software as a service or cloud-based computing. So you can actually build an application product, an enterprise software business, and actually then deliver it much more quickly into the marketplace and have 4,000, 5,000 customers in 10 years as opposed to 20 is what it took when you had just on-premise and land-based solutions. So from that perspective, our average company age has gone back from 19 years to about 12 and a half. Okay, on average, in terms of what we're buying now, not overall average, but what we're buying now, because they become mature much more quickly. So we are not changing where we invest in the life cycle of the company, still look for mature, mission-critical, business-critical enterprise software companies on platforms. add-on acquisitions, which are typically what I call product acquisitions, some can be as young as 4 or 5 years. And these are when we say, you know, we bought a business called Ventex, which you all were part of in Fund 3. This company made about 5 times our money. They dominated multiple spaces, but one of which was in nuclear power plants, and about 85%+ market share in that market. Well, when we bought one of the companies that made up Ventex, there was an add-on solution from a third-party vendor that had about 20% penetration in our market space. And it had only been around 4 or 5 years. We paid about $5 million for that add-on. 9 months later, we had a $50 million pipeline for that one product. So we will buy younger companies to the extent we view them as add-on opportunities. The last part of the question I think is important to hit. We're seeing, you know, a little bit of a dislocation. We'll see how big that actually is going to be in the capital markets. And what I think it will do is cause the same sort of phenomenon that we saw back in 07, 08, 09, where the venture capitalists now start to rationalize their portfolio. They've got 18 or 25 companies in their portfolio. They're going to say these 6 are going to survive. The rest are on their own. Those companies have typically been businesses that have been, I'll call it, you know, in the mode of rapidly growing and not profitable. And when they have to make a pivot because they can't raise any more capital, it can be challenging for those organizations. We've been quite effective at buying those businesses at what I call, you know, spectacular valuations, helping them manage that transition and doing extremely well, typically in our foundation fund because of the size of the companies. So to give you an example, you guys, you know, and Metratech was one of those businesses that actually went through that pivot, and we bought that business, and at the time, I think the VCs had put well over $100 million in capital in it. We bought it for about $30 million. We just sold it for about 8.7 times MOIC after about 4 years of holding. MicroEdge, the same way. VCs put about $80 million into it. We bought the company at for $28 million, and we've already sold part of it for 6.2 times MOIC, and we'll likely sell the rest for close to 10 times MOIC. So that's the sort of dynamic that I think is going to occur, and you know, we are in a great position competitively to take advantage of that. At the bigger end, I think the competition will continue to see more capital flow in, but it's going to be one-offs. Where people are saying, this is a great business, it's growing fast, let's pay a high multiple for it, as opposed to go through the actual transformational activities that we do at this end.
Mr. Smith, another question, and you may have answered it partly. It seems like you rely on new companies being formed where somebody has an idea that there's a niche that hasn't been met. Are there niches yet to be met?
That's a great question. What we rely on is, again, I think about it, the innovative dynamic that's occurring in enterprise software. And flip to page 38, I'm just going to give you a little bit of an illustration of that. And I have the good fortune every now and then of spending time with high schoolers and folks in college, and I say, if you're not learning how to write code, you should. Because the interesting thing is you have the ability in the enterprise software world to solve a demand and create huge value and opportunity. You can be walking down the street one day and see a car driving by that has an empty seat in it and say, I wish I could sit in that seat, and I'd pay him $20 to take me down the street. And all of a sudden, someone writes some code, they build this thing called Uber. So, you know, to a great extent, that is sort of capacity planning type software products fit almost every single industry. You can think about it, capacity planning for a hotel room or for music lessons. And companies like TIBCO, that's exactly what we do. So if you actually look at 38, what you actually see from 2007 to 2014, look in the small cap, the vast proliferation of the number of companies. Because this market space, A, is so valuable, B, your people are recognizing, and C, computing power is so available. You know, when I was growing up, you used to have to sign outside the room to actually get an hour of computer time. Now you have more computer, you know, capability available on your mobile phone than we had to actually do moon shots. So to a great extent, this vast proliferation of the number of companies is one of the things that we put our foundation fund against, and these are add-on acquisitions. The mid-cap market continues to expand often through consolidations, and frankly, these businesses are just becoming more and more valuable as people are starting to rely more and more on software to run their businesses. Everyone is automating various parts of their businesses. You know, if you're in the trucking business, 8 years ago, you were managing your fleet on a whiteboard in terms of where they went. Today, you're using products like OmniTrax. And so as people start to automate, companies start to automate more and more, you will see more and more businesses and software start to, you know, develop into mature companies with best-of-breed solutions. That's what we're looking for.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Go for it.
Okay. Could you talk a little bit about, you mentioned TIBCO, you know, as, you know, if you look a few years ago, what happened in private equity is the fund size grew larger and larger and larger, and they tended to get a little bit, in my opinion, overextended in terms of reaching for deals, and they did some outside deals that didn't work out particularly well. You're raising a larger fund now, you know, you're kind of coming off the heels of TIBCO. What, you know, where it seems like the performance is lagging a little bit. What are kind of the lessons learned so far in that story, and
sure.
How does that apply to kind of your thinking going forward?
Yeah, good questions. You know, again, I compare TIBCO again to companies like Mises. Again, these are billion-dollar revenue-type software companies, and mission-critical, business-critical. You know, TIBCO, you know, powers FedEx, it powers Delta Airlines, it powers almost every, you know, house on Wall Street to a great extent. It is still an essential product that needs and has, you know, what I call high maintenance capacity associated with it. You know, comma, however, when we buy companies like TIBCO, we know, you know, what the issues are going to be. The first one is, it is a, you know, call it a 45-50% recurring revenue business. We now have to transition to a higher recurring revenue business. And we do that contractually. We've done that multiple times, and it's a process by which you have to undergo that. You know, TIBCO, the biggest challenge that we had, again, being a Silicon-based company, we run into this all the time, and while we know it, it's often hard to fix initially, is you end up losing salespeople. Why? Because the unicorns. We have all, you know, the promise of the future out there, and people would start to attract your highly trained, specialized salespeople to come move to this new company that's now growing, you know, 150%, you know, quarterly, and we're going to take this thing public. Well, you know, not all those trees grow to the sky, and so we always have the challenge when we buy a Valley-based company to get, you know, to get our salespeople securely in their seats, and that's part of what we've been doing at TIBCO. We lost a number of salespeople, we're backing, you know, what I call the core group of the leaders back, but it took some time to do it. So that's one of the, you know, again, like I told the team, I said, look, this isn't something new, but we went through it. We just didn't get what I'll call enough of the incentive plans to keep those salespeople early on. And so we had to go back and go get them. And some of them now are coming back because they realize, oh, gee, trees don't grow to the sky and those unicorns. So that's one of the main lessons learned in a company like TIBCO. That said, we still are, you know, not only just optimistic, but still have it underwritten to the same value. Now, is it going to be 6 months or 9 months later? Most likely. And that's fine. So, you know, we'll still make our over 3x MOIC. This year, our expectation is to do 32% EBITDA margin on that business, converting now another 12% to recurring revenue. The following year, another 12-15% more in recurring revenue, and up to, call it, 35-38% EBITDA margin. And so kind of business as usual in that context. That's part of the whole Vista playbook in that way. You know, it is, you know, these businesses, just like we did with Mises, you know, you go through that transition period. Especially coming into that J curve, you get, and bigger companies, the fact of the matter is, it takes longer to make the changes. Mm-hmm. But when you make the changes, they have enormous benefit to the financial performance of those companies.
So I wanted to ask a question about the span of companies that you look at. It sounds like your the foundation fund, you can dip down into VC reject private companies, and then in the larger fund, you can buy small firms. How do you manage? That's a pretty broad range of different buyout strategies. How do you manage that? How does it work for your investment committee? How do you think about big differences between the big and Sequoia versus?
Got it. So the way we do it, you know, we have a just, I like to say these words carefully, but, you know, we are overrun with deals. You know, we go since 2013, we've looked at over almost 2,000 deals. And I like to always look at, you know, what's important to us is what does a company look like once we own it? And again, I focus principally on, you know, what are the value transformational activities that we can specifically put into those companies, and now what does that company look like? Now, once we see this is a valuable company, the one thing we're experts now is what I call the transaction part of the business. We've taken, I think, more than any other private equity firm in software, more companies private than any other. And part of that is we have a very specific methodology for doing that. We'll part of that is also a very strong legal team and legal infrastructure. You know, before I just hired a person, David Breach, who's in the room here, who was one of the most senior partners at Kirkland & Ellis, and before I hired him, you know, 6-7 years ago, I said, David, we need a team at Kirkland that supports our flagship fund, our foundation fund, so it operates just like the Vista engine. We have now over 45 lawyers at Kirkland who do nothing but focus on Vista deals in our underlying engine. And that's a part of making sure we have standards and consistency across our deals, from a $50 million deal to a $1.2 or $2.5 billion transaction. So that's that part of the equation. On the investment committee side, every company comes to investment committee, and again, it's unlike, I think, other private equity firms, usually 4, 5, 6, 7 times. And part of that is to make sure that the fundamental thesis of investing is sound. We've identified what transformational activities we're going to actually deploy in those businesses. And it starts at the, here's the investment thesis with the investment team manager. You know, who's at the management company, or probably the executive who's going to be managing specific transformational activities? Who from BCG is going to be managing those activities? And which one of our operating partners is now working on ensuring that that all works smoothly in terms of, you know, the resources deployed at the company and how we manage the executives, and we have the right executives to manage that transformational activity. A very specific, defined, I call it industrialized approach to doing it. So irrespective of whether it's a, you know, UK take private or a US take private, or, you know, purchase out of a from a portfolio company of a VC firm or from an individual, it goes through the same investment committee process. Part of that investment committee process, though, at the end, we talk about the deal dynamics every single time. And how do we actually manage the deal dynamics? We know what the companies work to us. Now the question is, how do we buy it at the lowest price that we can based on the deal dynamics? And that's one of the keys. If you know you can make those transformations, those businesses, how do you now buy it at the lowest price? And that's what I call, you know, myself and a few other senior folks really provide the day-to-day counsel with the deal captain on ensuring that we get those companies at those right prices. Hopefully that's helpful. Yes, sir.
I'm sold on the investment, so I'm moving beyond. I want to go back to something you said earlier that just struck my interest. You seem like a perfect spokesperson for this question of coding. You said you go to schools and you tell kids that they should learn to code. At what age do you think they should learn to code? And how successful do you think the education system has been in terms of providing that opportunity to young people? And yeah, what do you think we should do about it?
It's a great question. How young, you know, we see it in elementary schools, and I think it will continue. The earlier you're exposed them, the better off you're going to be. And just to give you just a personal example, of, you know, who knows if this actually works. But a lot of schools kind of get computers, or you get computers for kids. You know, one of the things with my son in particular, my oldest son, we built it together. I said, because I wanted him to understand the component parts of what is this computer, what does it look like, and what are the components, and how does it actually work. And now I'm starting to get him to learn how to code. And I sponsor personally through my philanthropic work efforts, you know, Women Who Code, Together We Code, a bunch of different programs. And the jury's out, quite frankly, as to what's the most effective. But I think, you know, call it as Americans, one thing we have to do is make sure we have create as many on-ramps as we can to coding for everyone we can. I think, again, the digitization of it, not everyone's going to be good at it. You know, we have these aptitude tests, and I can tell you who's going to likely be good at it and who isn't, with pretty, you know, decent degree of certainty. But the exposure part is critically important, because then you start to understand what coding actually does in terms of building what I call a specific system of engagement that has repeatability to it. And, you know, software doesn't do what you want it to do. It only does what you tell it to do. And it's a mindset of thinking that actually, as you get more youth involved in it, it can be actually an effective way of learning. So I actually think we should expose kids, frankly, at the elementary school level, you know, simple coding. You know, I didn't get exposed to it until high school, but changed my life dramatically. And I think that we should actually get to some fundamental basics and not just give them all laptops and think they'll do okay, because most will play games if given a choice. But, you know, I'd love to see them more, but I call uploading as opposed to downloading.
I really applaud that. I know my daughter's in school where she's learning coding at age 9, but I'm mindful of the fact that there's a huge and growing digital divide,
right,
in terms of opportunity. Not
absolutely
everybody gets access to that. So, Does Vista actually have a philanthropic wing?
Yeah, go on our website. It's got, we're one of the few private equity firms that actually has our community's page.
Could you just tell us a little bit about Top Line?
Sure.
You involved in the coding issue?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think if I were to look at overall in Vista over the last maybe 2 to 3 years, we probably have, call it reinvested back into our communities, well over $250 million. In various forms, everything from, you know, scholarships. I actually just personally made a grant in combination with the Funding Foundation, $50 million to Cornell School of Chemical Engineering. And part of that is, of course, to create these on-ramps for folks who don't have access. So, you know, that's an important part of what I call our culture of our firm is give back. And we focus on environmental issues and with GWC, to ensure that there's equal access to, you know, in this case, it's education, educational opportunities, as well as, you know, probably 19 or 20 other opportunities, things we do in Haiti and, you know, Nicaragua and a bunch of other places. But that's kind of the nature of our gang. You know, that's, we view that we're very fortunate in having created a wonderful business and we like to deliver back in the communities in which we live. And you'll see if you do it at a local level, regional level, national level, and a global level.
I really appreciate that. I mean, that personally, that's important to me. And thanks as a dad, building a computer with your son, thanks for making the rest of us look.
Trust me, I had to go watch it. I watched YouTube before he came in the room. And, oh, yeah, I'm gonna do so. And then I get stuck on a park and say, go outside for a little while.
Well, I can testify personally. My grandniece is a high school senior, and she was accepted in Seattle in a women's encoding program where she was personally mentored by a woman at Adobe. And she was fluent in Japanese and found a lot of correlation between the aptitudes of a foreign language and coding. She loves it, and she's going to a college where she can major, a double major that way.
That's spectacular.
So it transformed her life.
It is, you know, it's amazing to me, and, you know, just to not beat this up too much, but I think it's important. If you flip back to page, you know, 34, and, you know, when I grew up, those companies on the left, those blue chip stock companies were companies, some of which I worked for, some I wanted to work for, you know, coming in and out of college. And it's amazing to me if you actually add up the market caps, and this is last, the beginning of the year, fall, if you add up the market caps, they're all smaller than Apple. So you start thinking about all the technology-enabled businesses over to the right, and, you know, for the most part, many of these didn't exist, you know, 15 years ago. You know, remember, our iPhones didn't come out until 2007. And you just see what that platform has actually done in terms of transforming opportunities. You know, we would not have companies like Uber if you did not have an iPhone platform. So those are the, you know, the opportunities you see on the next page, on 35, which are, you know, these unicorns, as we call them, some of which will survive and some won't. But it is these platforms that if you actually have, you know, efficient software delivery mechanisms that create massive amounts of value and opportunity. And so when I, you know, lead the high schools, I tell them, if you aren't programming, you need to tell your parents you want to start programming tomorrow. And for the parents, I tell them you need to demand your school districts that they give you the opportunity to do this.
Any other questions?
Just a couple on the. By the way, you know, I think, you know, on some of the charity work you've done, I think it's great. And I think I believe you're on the board at the chair of the board at the Center for RFK Center for Human Rights.
And thank you.
And you know, you should be commended for that. That's great. But speaking of board positions, it looks like a number of your top senior management principals have a large number of board positions. Are you guys able to manage through that, or how do you manage through that? Because just time slicing between, you know, 15 and 19 boards, that's pretty heavy duty work.
It all comes down to, again, the model. The model is different. You know, this, our board positions aren't, you know, sit there at the board once a quarter and provide advice and counsel. Okay. What we are really looking at is, if you look at the first 4, 5, 6 pages of each one of our board books, they all look the same. And is, where are you on implementing these VSOPs? It's pretty simple. You know, I think about it. The financial performance is a trail in the sand. It's a function of what projects that you've identified to create value, and where are you in executing on those projects. That's where we spend our time. The vast majority of now what I call the energy inputs into the portfolio comes now from BCG. You know, BCG, we have now over 86, you know, subject matter experts who drive in those transformational activities at a functional level within each one of the portfolio companies. It isn't sitting back in McKinsey like, here's what we need you to do. It is, no, here's how we build a customer prospect database. Here's a template we're going to use. Here's the information we have to gather. Here's the timeline in which we need to gather it. Here's how we're going to actually price this. It is very specific, and the question is when, you know, how long it takes you to do that. You would be amazed in some larger companies that they actually, many of them don't actually have all their contracts in one place, either visually or physically, and you just can actually understand what it is you sell to whom before you can think about upselling something to them. So all that is a functional process. So in my mind, you know, we typically aren't stretched thin. I've never heard a complaint from any one of my investment professionals about being overrun with that activity level at the board, because we have, again, another 80-plus people who in BCG, and, of course, the operating partners, and their job is to ensure that all of that dynamic occurs effectively.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Madam Chairman. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Simply as when we got their board presentation, it said draft on it, and it still says draft on it, and I kind of pushed them. I said, let's get that off of there, and they're very adamant that it's never final. They're never done, and that's the whole VSOPs, the whole consulting group, they just keep pushing, and one of the concerns is success. You know, are they going to, is the group going to continue to progress after success? These guys just aren't going to touch.
So I think Andy teed up the recommendation to start, but it's we're recommending a $500 million commitment to the expansion.
So can I ask a couple questions on that? So on the commitment, would it be into the Class A or the Class B? And what's your thinking, what's your reasoning behind that?
It would be the Class B, the conventional, 1.5 and 20 over 8. And having modeled this a couple times, obviously the pace of deployment realization has an impact, but if you make simplifying assumptions, it's the crossover points are about 2x growth, which they have consistently outperformed, and we certainly wouldn't be recommending $500 million if we thought they were going to be 2x growth. So in those scenarios, north of that, you're better off at a 20% carry.
Intuitively, that seems to make sense.
Yeah. Carry is an important data point in those calculations.
Yeah.
So at $500 million, will we be among their larger investors in this fund?
No. I think there's some sovereign wealth funds that will look to do about $1 billion. So
in the first fund that we invest in, Fund 3, I think there are 25 LPs and maybe 3 or 4 on the advisory boards when we were one of them. And, you know, we stayed smaller relative as the fund size grew. But now the word's out on this list, so everybody's knocking down the door. You know, they'll be able to raise as much as they want. There will be a hard cap on it.
There will be a hard cap?
Yeah. I mean, we're looking, negotiating the legals right now, but I mean, there's a point that it gets a bit obnoxious. You know?
Could you talk a little bit about how you got comfortable with the GCB? Because in terms of leakage, potential leakage, the ownership there is different, right, than the ownership in the fund. Right, so do we have comfort that the rates they're charging, or however it's the setup is really that there isn't leakage from the fund to that entity?
So the very simple answer is there is a annual cap on what every portfolio company can pay to GCG. And they have historically, they give us a lot of transparency on this. Historically run BCG break even or loss. But I would, it's an excellent question when we spend a lot of time on it because it's an area that you could potentially see. I think, you know, candidly, and it's amazing, this is actually the largest operating team in the private equity industry. You think about the the size of this resource. And it becomes more impressive when you think that they only do one thing. They have this 80 people who only look at software companies. So the point was made over and over that that's the secret sauce. It's ultimately about the change they can implement in businesses that makes this thing go.
And they're getting a lot better, I think, around the transparency, recognizing that there is industry sensitivity to the concept. And, you know, each fund, I think, has gotten incrementally better on the restrictions and disclosures around ECG. So Mike's right, we have more data now than we ever did. And it's a unique model, and that is how they drive the value. So it would be, I think, very challenging to replicate that in another way. But it has, you know, some challenges associated with it, for sure.
I think a point I try to underwrite, too, is if the market crashes, who do I want holding my investments? And I'd rather have Vista holding our software investments than pretty much anybody in the world because of the ECG.
Yeah, I think not to belabor the point, but there is a handful, literally maybe five GPs in the world that you think about, that operate with a niche strategy and really are just strategics that invest through buyout funds. That's what this is. The conversation, the dialogue that they have with companies is just fundamentally different from other companies.
So, Mike, at a high level, I'm thinking kind of my P brand. We took some off of some of our legacy buyout partners, and it looks like the excess capacity is up-leveling Vista to the KKR level. Right? So, it will be one of our flagship relationships. So what are those, TPG, KKR, and Apollo?
Blackstone is in that group. And I think we'll come back to it in the plan, but that's part of the go-forward strategy is just tightening that band of commitment. So this informal cap of 500 is where we're cutting people off at. We'll want to migrate relationships like this one that have the capacity up to that level.
Right. So if I remember the competitive landscape graph, TPG and Blackstone were both on there. So how do you think about how our flagship relationships compete or overlap? Does it matter? Is that important to you?
I think it's particularly when it comes to software, it's a bit harder. Vista has proven that these are good businesses from a recurring revenue standpoint that can be levered. So everyone is racing to get into this part of the market. So we will have increasing exposure regardless of what we do. Vista to software, and some of it will come under the banner of business services. I mean, like Robert said, everything's kind of a software company from some perspective. I think we're comfortable gaining exposure in this sector because of the attributes to the company, because it is sticky revenues and high margins. I think one of the things that Robert alluded to is that you have a lot of, there's a handful of very good software managers, there's a lot of tourists and to Andy's point, when things correct, if leverage is not available at 7-8 times, if people aren't paying 15 times, those people will have to move out of the market and it'll come back to the Vistas of the world. The other big ones, I would say TPG's been active, Hellman & Friedman's been active. I think a lot of the others want to buy Vista companies or co-invest with Vista.
So their process seems very regimented. I mean, it sounds like they do the same thing for small as they do for the large, and that's kind of their way to boost everyone. You fit into our system.
Yes.
So if they have this system, what's to stop someone, TPGs, or from basically copying that system and replicating it, and, you know, or someone that we don't have the investment with? You know, what makes it...
I think people are trying, for sure. There's one or two that do not have anywhere near the resources but have a similar playbook. I think what's unique about Vista, again, coming to Andy's point, we've all been sitting across the table from Robert for about 10 years now, and we've witnessed the scale of this business, the rapid growth of this business. He's never stopped talking about the downside and attacking the single point of failure. So kind of like lean manufacturing, attack the bottleneck, then figure out what the next bottleneck is. He's, you know, really forward-thinking from a continuous improvement perspective. So that's, people will try to catch up, but they're far behind, and these guys are moving really fast with respect to their operations.
So, to your point, he needs to be a Secretary of Education.
Yeah. He needs to be the CEO of Vista.
He does for our purposes here, but I just like the fact that he has a bigger vision that's consistent with what he's trying to do in terms of his corporate life, too. And it's a really, I had lots of thoughts running through my brain.
Well, I think that he mentioned the VSOPs, it was 20 years ago, it's
right.
80 now.
Yeah, he's an engineer by trade. His engineered process is constantly changing to attack a specific niche in the private equity industry. And the constantly changing part is the thing that nobody's going to be able to catch up with.
And nobody's deployed that volume of capital specifically into software to have had sort of the dynamic learning of those VSOPs over the last 15 years. And I think there's a tremendous amount of power of that real-time learning curve that they've gone through.
Listen, he had me and he built the computer for his...
So what's number two?
Brian Shepard.
What I was struck with is when he pointed out on page 34 the contrast between the blue chips and the technology stocks that are largely software companies. They don't own any of those companies. Those are companies that I know, and they're basically the SAPs and the Googles and so on. They're in this almost a secret niche. Companies. When I looked at all the companies that they own, there wasn't a name that I knew. Now, that's my ignorance, but it's.
Well, if you were in one of the verticals that one of those companies served, you'd absolutely know because it's critical to that vertical operation.
You probably know MRI as a property management software.
No, I don't. Oh. So I'm the perfect ignorant person.
So do we have any other questions before we? Have a motion?
I'll move staff approval.
Second for staff recommendation, excuse me.
Still second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to your first time up here.
This is Jeff Goldberger from Story Cove, by the way.
It's a silent guy, so who makes all the difference. We know that.
They do all the work.
That's right.
We know that. Have you lived it?
So I want to just briefly interrupt and announce that we've been told there's a GMC Yukon in the parking lot with Oregon plates, LTS SB1 with its lights on.
Well done.
Oh, you just stayed.
Yeah, we just stay up here.
So this is pretty exciting. This is like a new one for us, private equity review with our staff. Taking the lead and doing
your
own review.
Well, I think exciting is probably an expectation I can't live up to.
That won't be in the notes.
All topics are in now.
As a newbie, I appreciate people introducing themselves when you come to speak. I should know the names, but I will eventually.
So, Mike Nyman, Tom Martin, Dave Fanu will take us through the private equity review and annual plan. We'll try and be as efficient as possible. You'll see in the package that there's actually two presentations, one from staff and one from Torrey Cove. But to make this as functional as possible, because I'm not going to be able to hold it together by trying to talk to you back and forth, I'll make some high-level comments about the information you'll see in our package, and to the extent necessary, we'll flip pages in the Torrey Cove packages, because I think there's some more consequential exhibits in them. So from an agenda standpoint, I thought what we'd do is do a quick run-around of the environment we've been operating in over the last year. At a high level, then we'll dive into a review of where the program is at and come back with the recommendations and plan that we have for next year. We don't have a specific voting item here, so it's a bit more of an informational session. And we're here ready to speak about any and all things private equity. So if that agenda is not where you want to go, please stop and we'll change course as needed. So to start with the update on the environment, as we, I think the first point I would make is that, you know, private equity is really a sub-segment of the global corporate M&A market. So you would expect to see an active corporate M&A market resulting in an active private equity environment. And by any measure, the last year and the last couple of years have been banner years for global corporate M&A activity. I think by some measures and data is notoriously bad in this part of the world, but Dealogic is estimating that there were $5 trillion of corporate M&A transactions announced over the course of the year, which is an eye-popping figure, and really 10% above the last peak, which would have been 2007. Not surprisingly, that activity skewed to the large end, so there's about 10 transactions announced during the year with enterprise values above $50 billion, which is not something we've seen before. And the financial pages pretty much every day during the year were big multi-billion-dollar transactions on the front of the Wall Street Journal. Again, not surprisingly, that corresponds to high prices and high leverage. With respect to leverage, I think that the loan and high-yield part of the market, so the part of the market that, that private equity lives in, there's about $900 billion of new issue volume in the U.S. and Europe, which is a big number from a historical perspective, but it's actually a bit down from where 2014 was, and 14 was actually a bit down from where 13 was.
I do have to say, if I may, comparing our circumstance now to 2007 isn't terribly comforting.
Well, let me just jump directly to that, because I would say private equity as a market share of corporate M&A has generally been about 25 to 30% since the market got to scale in 2000. Private equity is an asset class that got to scale. This year it was about 25%. So all the things I just said about corporate M&A, high prices, lots of volumes, bigger deals, high leverage, those apply to private equity. However, I think there's a couple of signals that would say that we're not in 2007, but the sort of, the fact of the matter is in 2007, the previous M&A bubble, that was overtly private equity led. It was really large public to private transactions in the U.S. led by sponsors. So that was a private equity driven bubble. Today, even though market share was maintained, it is completely a corporate M&A bubble. It's been the strategic buyers driving the bubble recently. And M&A activity, private equity can be on either side of that trade, right? So I referenced the buy side part of the trade, but the last several years have been a massive realization opportunity. 2015 will end up being the biggest year for liquidity in the history of the asset class, and it's breaking the record set in 2014. So it's been a wonderful period to be selling companies, and our experience reflects that completely. We'll come to that in the update portion. From a return standpoint, it's no secret that private equity has trailed the public markets really since the financial crisis. As an industry, we're still working through a glut of very large deals that drove that vast bubble that are still sitting in funds. That's been a big drag on the industry. And we're getting to the point where it's no longer just a function of a drag on returns. Those transactions are held in partnerships that are getting late in their life. So now we're dealing with structural end-of-life issues as well. And we'll come back to that in a few minutes. So that's the high-level update. The last thing I wanted to touch on with respect to environment is really fundraising. And this is one of the key takeaways I think we'll leave with. Fundraising today is white hot in private equity. I mean, it's really very, very strong. I don't think you'll see a material change in the quantum of capital raised, which is to say, I don't think the 2015 fundraising data will look that much different than 2014 did. It won't be a step change in the number of the amount of capital raised. There's just a lot more demands chasing that supply. And the reasons are obvious. I mean, every institutional investor in the world is looking at a set of capital markets assumptions and operating against a return hurdle that sort of dictates that to get there over the long run, you need private equity. So we have more demand to get into funds today than I think we ever have before. And the practical result of that is fundraising timelines have been compressed massively. The amount of time we have from the announcement of the fundraising to availability of the data room to please give us comments on the LPA. Very, very short today. The other piece is, once we get to that LPA negotiation, because of the excess demand, the leverage is firmly on the side of the GPs. So I offer that up because while the other things I commented on were exposed to, this is the part, this is the front lines, this is where we operate. So when we think about update on the plan and our go-forward plan, this is just the background as we think about that. I'd be remiss not to say that I've just said a lot of things about the 2015 environment, and I think we all would recognize that the end of 2015 and the beginning of 2016 might not look like that. So fundraising has not changed. It's actually gotten stronger, so that piece remains the same. Corporate M&A, we continually see big transactions. It was a big one announced today, so that has not abated. Private equity is much more sensitive on price and leverage. So from a new deal perspective, things have slowed considerably. I mean, I think the GPs are taking a wait and see on where prices will settle out, and it would be challenging to finance something today if you had to. So that's a bit of an update on where we are today. Turn it over to Tory Cove to rebut what I just said.
I don't think there's any rebuttal. I think it's there's embellishment. The first piece is the consequence of the high demand bifurcated fundraising market where the best funds get raised literally overnight is that there's a lot less discipline in the marketplace about terms, conditions, and fees. And so we're seeing the very best funds starting to dictate, in some cases, premium management fees, some cases, premium period interest, in some cases, the elimination of preferred returns, and in some cases, changes to the clawback provisions. And so one of the dilemmas you're going to need to be facing in this current environment is the ability to access the very best managers while still abiding by some of the things you all thoughtfully put together a few years ago, which is your principles surrounding the private equity marketplace, specifically relating to management fees and terms and conditions. There's so much sovereign wealth fund money and so much high net worth money, endowment money as well, all chasing the private equity class, because that's the only way they can generate interesting rates of insurance in this environment. So that's point number one.
Hey, David, on that point, do you think we're going to see the kind of expansion of the distribution of results out of the private equity, much the way kind of what we saw in the venture industry, where you had a lot of either outperformance or underperformance from the median returns?
We're already seeing that. There is a wide disparity of returns, and the top quartile funds are generating, and you'll see this in some of the data here, the top quartile funds generate a significant premium over median quartile performers. And obviously, there will be a lot of people who lose money. We don't have clear crystal balls to say every manager we recommend for you all will be top quartile, but we do have conviction that there are firms like Vista that will continue to outperform the relative marketplace. The second piece
of... Could I ask you a question related to that, David? I'm sorry to interrupt. It's a good provocative point to make. So you're seeing compression on the LP side in terms of making decisions and committing capital. Doesn't it also follow that on the GP side, they're also being compressed in terms of their ability to evaluate and take advantage of potential deals?
Well, this is a great segue to John's point, circling back to 2007. We're in an environment today where deals are getting stuck. Carlyle recently tried to do a fairly large deal for Symantec and couldn't get the high yield placed out and actually had to change the deal in certain terms. And so for the first time in probably the last five, the high yield market is risk-based priced now. And so you're seeing yields shoot up considerably. You know, give you an example, when Warren Buffett and 3G bought Heinz, they got some high yield paper done at around 4%, which was an extraordinary rate to get for a high yield piece of paper. Today, if you look at the high yield index, it's trading north of 10. And so Over the last 6 months, we saw a systemic change in the marketplace where risk was actually finally introduced to the high yield marketplace. And you're seeing that significantly in the energy sector. Multiples are being compressed. We think we're going into a downturn. In fact, if you use the public market proxy, things are 10% cheaper today than they were.
Let me steer you in a different direction, because I was actually getting to a slightly different point.
Okay.
Are they going to be able to provide the same level of due diligence and the same level of discretion and thoughtfulness that they've provided to deals in the past, or are they going to be required through a compressed time frame, more competition, and more information on the market to take more leaps of faith? In other words, is this going to become more speculative at exactly the same time that we're asked to jump faster?
Well, the best way to answer it is we're going to a period of time where companies are going to be trading cheaper and the number of potential other buyers are going to reduce. I think there's a lot less corporate confidence in 2016 than there was in 2015. So in the past, when you looked at an interesting company to buy, not only were you competing against other financial buyers, other leveraged buyers and private equity buyers, you were competing against publicly traded companies, and frequently you were competing against the possibility of initial public offering. January 2016 was the first time in the last 6 years where there were no public offers because of the market volatility. So you're taking one segment, one X possibility away. Corporate buyers are disappearing in most verticals because they have a lot less confidence about their stock price. And they're a little bit less confident about their earnings outlook. And so we're potentially going to a period where there are fewer corporate buyers. Private equity is sitting on over $1.6 trillion, $1.6 trillion of dry powder. So there is a lot of money in private equity. But the harder piece is getting the financing done for deals. And so we're actually going to go to a period of time where there are going to be fewer competitors overall for a potential opportunity. And the financing marketplace is going to be a challenging one. And so we actually think multiples are going to be lower today. And getting to John's point about 2007, private equity does best in times of volatility and uncertainty from an investment return performance perspective. If you look at the performance of private equity in 2002 to 2004, those vintage years funds did terrific. If you look at the vintage years of 2008 and 2009, those were the best recent performing vintage years. If we go through another period of correction and dislocation like what Robert described, we will have an interesting time to be a buyer of companies because you're finding out lower multiples. And private equity has the benefit of fairly long holding periods to go out to other potential buyers.
I think I would add that
thanks, Dave.
There's a lot of things that have just played out that add additional capacity. The GPs have more execution capacity today than they did 5 years ago. And they've just been through a wave of selling a lot of companies, so they've freed up the time and attention of the professionals within the firm. The other piece to reiterate is, as we were in a white-hot environment, and that's when you see people competing on time, showing up with a fully binding bid and not really going through all the steps, because it's going to take them more time to round up financing, because the documentation the banks are going to require to actually be able to syndicate the debt, that's sort of a forced discipline that we should see come back to the market.
To your point, these are times when you start to see people get off strategy, and that's where it's incumbent upon us to do the best that we can in the diligence effort to understand core confidence, conviction, and their ability to stay within that fairway that they've been successful, because people do deviate, and that's where that dispersion of returns that we think is coming, you know, will come into play.
So circling back to your point of view about static terms and conditions and having to operate in a dynamic negotiating environment. So if you're seeing that the external negotiating environment is changing and we had a point of view about key terms, how do we respond to that strategically or at the policy level? What are you saying? I'm having trouble processing the conclusion.
I think it's a moving target as we sit here today because, you know, there's fundamental economic terms that we'll see change for the best managers. They'll get away with that. We're seeing across the board, giving themselves real flexible language around if they disclose something, it's allowed in terms of, you know, payments coming back and forth between the companies. So they're really tightening up their game around that. So I think to answer your question, I don't have an answer for we should pick these terms and focus on those. We need to have a broader conversation, frankly, about which are the most important things to us and what are the deal killers. Because that's what we're thinking about internally. Which of these things they're asking for are the acceptable ones, the walk issues, and which are not.
So I hear you that a dynamic process for thinking about what's most important, considering that we're headed toward a period of dispersion and we're going into best managers. I can hear that and understand. Then I'm taking the next step structurally. Is the way that we think about approving these transactions a problem given the market that you're facing, right, with our committee plus board structure? Is that okay? Have you seen other ways of managing this that are more effective in responding to the dynamic environment?
I think this is going to be an unsatisfactory answer, but I think a flexible approach, you know, taking each one at a time.
So the structure is not a problem.
The structure
is the underlying judgment on deal terms.
We're getting smarter every time about what they're asking for. And I think part of the problem we're wrestling with is because it's a white hot environment, they're going to get away with some of these things. Not really the economics one. The LPs will continue to demand that. That only goes to the best manager. But some of the flexibility on investment mandate, stuff like that. We're not crazy about some of the things they're asking, but to the extent it's making its way into closed funds, it becomes the norm. Everyone else adopts it. And then if you sort of stomp your feet on that one and say, we don't accept this, we could find ourselves out of the market pretty quickly because this stuff has a way of cascading through everyone else's stocks.
Yeah, I would say a little bit differently, but echoing the same themes. It's hard being high maintenance in this environment, and I don't mean to say that as a pejorative, but anybody that isn't a simple yes or no in some cases creates complexity for the general partner, and it's easy for them if they have the right to pick and choose to simply say, I don't want you in my deal. You are no longer the biggest investor in the marketplace. There are a lot of people who are willing to write checks 2, 3, 5 times your size, and many times doing creative deals, including putting permanent capital on the balance sheets of some of the general partners. And so that has changed the game a bit for you all. And so I think every one of the terms is a risk-reward assessment, and you do need to pick and choose what you're willing to sacrifice if you want to be with the very best managers.